Let's start again.
I'm Austin Jakubiak, and I'm just going to present some kind of projects that are ongoing. And I called this presentation Large Daylight Simulations, which sounds a little ostentatious, but basically the idea is the projects that we're going forward with involve either a very large radiance model or large amounts of data that have to be sifted through after the fact in some way. So I'm going to present three kind of ongoing works. So actually, this top one, photovoltaic potential maps, is basically done, and these other two are just getting started, so it's a bit of a mix of how much information you'll get, but I hope it's kind of at least interesting to everyone. So the first project is called Towards Validated Urban Photovoltaic Potential Maps. And just a little background is that these maps are existing in a large number of cities, especially in the U.S. I'm not sure about in Europe yet. But the idea is you can find your house or click on it, type in your address, and get some sort of information about, well, how effective would it be to put PV panels on your roof, and how much energy would you save, how much would it cost, what would the payback period be, things like that. So the idea is that these are tools that the cities employ to kind of promote their sustainable image, as well as to kind of encourage people to put PV panels on their roofs. So in the US, there's quite a large collection of big cities that have these kinds of maps, but we weren't really sure how they actually worked at first, so started with a bit of an investigation. So questions were like, what kind of simulation algorithms do they use? What geometry do they use? How do they consider climates? And once we know that, well, how accurate is all of that? And then, of course, we ask ourselves, as we often would, can we do better than that? So in the end, we built a radiance model of the city of Cambridge and used it to kind of produce a similar map that we actually think is much better. And we validated it against an actual PV system in the end, so we'll get all to that. So but basically, in terms of simulation programs, these maps use three different ways. Actually, most shocking is that a large portion of them just used a solar constant. They applied to every piece of the roof, no matter which direction it looks, no matter what buildings surround it. So really just assumed every building in the city was the same. It's absurd, right? And a couple of maps, or one actually, used NREL's PV watts, which is good because it has a relatively good algorithm. Can account for roof orientation, but it can't, say, account for shading or reflections from the environment. And the most popular tool was something put out by ESRI. It's a geographic information systems firm, and you might have heard of ArcGIS. And within that, it's called Solar Analyst. And basically, they build a pixel-based representation of the city and use that to calculate shading coefficients against the sky, but they can't do reflections and don't generate a 3D model. Another shortcoming of Solar Analyst is that you, I should explain this chart, it's direct horizontal irradiation from the Boston-Logan weather file on the x-axis, and diffuse horizontal radiation on the y-axis for every hour that the sun is up in Boston, in the weather file. And what Esri makes you do is they make you pick a single like value for the direct diffuse ratio. And you can just see from this, it's like almost impossible to pick a single value, so they don't really consider climate very well. Furthermore, about half of the maps consider that every building in the city is flat, and they just extrude them to a height. And only about, you know, the other half is basically considering some sort of detailed roof form in these simulations. So with all that said, we can say that the models that exist may not be the best, and we wanted to see how plausible it was to use specifically DaySim in the production of a map. And Cambridge is a large city. It's about 6 square miles of area, 17,000 buildings. And so we wanted to try to just build a really large scale model, simulation model, and see how we did. So the first thing is to actually generate a 3D model of the city, which is honestly a pretty daunting task. I showed an example here for a little part of the MIT campus. So this is what the campus looks like. You can see there's different buildings, different types of trees, roof shapes, HVAC equipment, and stairwells that come out at the top. So there's a lot of variety in this scene. And we had a data set, which a lot of cities are beginning to generate now, basically a point cloud of the entire city derived from a LIDAR survey, which is basically a plane flying over in zigzags and taking laser point measurements. So there are about 126 million points for Cambridge, which was a bit too much to just triangulate and call it a model. So we implemented a bit of an algorithm that classified it into buildings and landscape, and also kind of just like sorted through the neighbors and the neighboring neighbors and the neighboring neighbors and saw like which points can be deleted safely because there's not much change and which points could be kept. So after a couple of iterations of that, we had about 9 million points. And then we just triangulated that into using Delaunay triangulation. And so the wall resolution is not very good just by the way I did it. But the rooftop resolution is quite good. So this was like a doubly curved building, and it's represented rather faithfully. The HVAC equipment is still there. Peaks are shown. So we were pretty happy with it just from a visual standpoint. And that led to a radiance model of about 16.5 million triangles, which we couldn't build on Windows, but we could on Linux, which was just fine because this had to be put into a bit of a simulation cluster to work properly. So once we had the model, of course we can put it into DaySim, we can do all the things that we know DaySim does. We can use a typical climate file to generate Perez skies for every hour. We can account for reflections from objects in the city. And we're pretty happy with that. We use 2 ambient bounces, a fair amount of ambient divisions, and one of the things we really had to think about was like what the ambient resolution should be, because it's such a large model that there's some kind of helpful guides to that. And we wanted to just compare the two systems a bit. I'll go through this part quickly. So we chose 5 flat roof buildings and 5 buildings that are kind of more complex in the roofs. And this is annual irradiation we're comparing here because the other models don't allow you to get hourly data. Some of them allow monthly data. So here we have the DaySim model on the x-axis and the Esri solar analyst tool on the y-axis. And really the thing you get out of this is that the DaySim model predicts a bit more radiation, which could be because of the climate. It also could be because we're calculating for reflections. And there's, of course, geometric resolution issues on this. So you see that like because of the resolution that Esri builds their pixel map at, sometimes you have edges that are not well resolved. It's something that could be improved with a higher resolution of sampling. And if you, the real kicker is if you compare the detailed roof model we made of Cambridge against like a model where all the buildings are flat, here on the y-axis, if you have all the roofs flat in Cambridge, basically every building is getting above 1,300 kilowatt hours per meter squared per year, which just makes no sense. That's like to say about half of these maps are essentially making not even in the right ballpark of the correct kind of data. You can see it a little bit better in these Jenkins of sky images. So this is a bit of the Harvard campus in this case with detailed roofs. And this is what happens if you see them all flat. So if a roof is flat, it basically will tell you can put PV panels anywhere and everywhere, and then your roof area will be incorrect as well. So there's all kinds of problems there. And so then we wanted to actually use this hourly data to calculate energy. In simplest form, the energy you get out of a PV system is going to be a function of the efficiency of the panel, the inverter efficiency, the actual temperature at each hour, the solar insulation, and kind of like some sort of degradation over time for age. There's this useful equation that basically calculates temperature as a function of irradiance from the Handbook of Photovoltaic Engineering, which we found didn't work very well in rooftop conditions, but I'll get to that later. And so from that, and using some sort of economic models, we were able to classify basically every point in the city that we simulated is about 250,000 points in this model, I think. So covering all of the buildings, like where it would make economic sense in terms of a 10-year projection to install PVs, where it would make a little less sense, and where it would make like almost no sense at all. So we wanted to validate this. I mean, you could see this as a validation of the model or a validation of radiance if you want, but so we had a test system in a building located here, and about a kilometer away there's actually a handy weather station that publishes irradiation data as well as temperature data every 15 minutes. And we also had every hour the output from the PV system, so we had a good set of data to kind of build a test against. So here's the system in a little bit more detail. There's 24 PV panels. It's relatively small. They look about like this. They're practically coincident with the roof, which is what our model is assuming in all cases, that the panels would be coincident with the roof. These are at a 5-degree tilt. And we knew a lot of information about the panels, and we had the radiance models here on the right-hand side. So we updated all our calculation parameters with what we knew about the panels, and we calibrated for the weather file during the time we were measuring. I'll come back to the slide, actually. So in red here is the actual predicted generation of the energy for a week in the summer, and the blue is the actual generation of the systems. The bottom is winter. You see the agreement is quite good, but it wasn't at first. This dashed black line, something important to explain, is what happens if you don't account for temperature properly. So if you just use the ambient temperature or, say, the values from the Handbook of Photovoltaic Engineering, you get quite off when it's hot outside because PV panels are less efficient when they get hot. We corrected that with something called the solar temperature. It's just the ambient temperature plus the emissivity times the irradiance over a convective loss coefficient. So it's a gain that's associated with the irradiation, more or less. And once we make that correction, we get very close. So the other thing to note is that the other maps, like say the Esri's method, only give you gross annual data. And you can't do this correction. You're probably in the summer predicting on an order of like 20 to 30% extra energy that wouldn't really make sense in those circumstances. So we found that kind of interesting. This looks terrible on the projector, but so we're able to transform that kind of data into a large map of the city, more or less, where people can actually click on their house and get the same kind of data, but also spatially located on the roof, so all the radiance points are represented there. And so you can get a sense of looking at your house or your building, like where should I put my PVs? In this case, you put them on the south side, not on the north side. It's a little bit of intuitive there, but we also have this kind of validation to back it up. So we're pretty happy about it. We're looking into streamlining the process a bit more for using radiance in these kinds of situations, whereas before, it's not necessarily easy to deal with large amounts of geometry or how do you geolocate these points back for a display in a map. There's a bit of back and forth there. So now I'm going to present the two projects that I said are kind of more in flux. This is called Causes of Glare in the Urban Environment. I just didn't have a title for it yet. What it really is there's this airport. This is a view from an air traffic control tower, actually. So we were actually invited by this airport to look at something slightly foolish that happened there. They had an architecture or consulting firm install photovoltaic panels north of their air traffic control tower. So here's the photovoltaic panels, and here's the runway that they have to look at. You can already see the problem. Basically, these panels, when we were there, were reflecting like over 250,000 candela per meter squared luminance. They're incredibly bright, really. And you want to focus on this monitor and the runway. So the monitor is about 150 candela, and the runway is about 3,000 candela. And then you have something that's two orders of magnitude above the runway. It basically completely, it's not even discomfort glare at this point. It's actually disabling glare. You really literally can't see the airplane. And it's so bright, you have like after effects when you look away from it. And they're quite horrified by this, obviously, and they need something to do about it. Right now, what they do is they cover the panels with tarps. So here you see, they took down the tarps so we could take that photo. But they were putting them back up right afterwards so they could resume actually working safely. And here's a view of the control tower in the distance from underneath one of the arrays. So these are really large, probably over 1,000 panels out there. I haven't actually counted yet. But it's like that's actually quite a large amount of energy, their potential energy they're covering up there. So our job now is to characterize the material properties of these panels, and they have a set of remediations they want us to look at, and then we're probably going to propose some of our own. So we didn't really have the budget for a gonio photometer measurement, but we did have on hand kind of one of these Konica Minolta spectrophotometers, so we can get the diffuse characteristics of the panel and the specular characteristics within a 10 degree exiting angle. So there's a little bit of missing of potential forward scattering that we can't characterize very well there, but we can try to like play with the roughness values and materials to figure it out. One thing they really want us to do is to look at the currently installed panel and look at like a proposed alternative panel, which is interesting, because you wouldn't think there'd necessarily be big visual differences between PV panels, but there turn out to be. You can probably recognize this as a sun power panel for anyone who does this kind of stuff. And so the black is the installed panel and the gray is the custom panel, and these are just for different areas of the panel. But if you area weight everything out, the second panel that they propose to install in its place reflects about half the diffuse and about two-thirds or kind of close to half of the specular component as well. So there is a big visual difference between them, but when you're talking orders of magnitude, even if you half, it doesn't do a whole lot. So even installing the better panel, it's not going to do very much in that case. We took HDR photographs as well. So the installed panel, just standing out in the sun with it, you get about 1.3 million candela, and you get about 0.7 million candela on the alternate panel. I mean, I guess the real thing to get from this is they actually reflect quite a lot. They also asked us to take pictures of them with the zoom lens from the air traffic control tower. I'm not sure how useful these are, but it's part of the tests they demanded of us. But going forward, we're going to be looking at different shading control strategies, the idea of potentially moving the panels around, and we may even be asked to participate on the stand in a lawsuit. So, so the final project, which is probably the least developed in a way, is a validation of something I presented in 2010 at the Radiance Workshop. It's basically glare prediction in the large daylight space, but also the idea that someone might move around. So the large daylight space is actually the Harvard Graduate School of Design, because I was there at the time. And there's about, it looks like this, there's these top lights that are kind of clerestories, and at the ends there are basically large panes of glass. And there's about 500 students who sit in here, and they all have like relatively open workspaces. They're really just like 90 degree angle back of the desk plus like a plane that's like large and a big piece of plywood. So the idea, as I showed a little bit yesterday, is that, well, these students actually don't have any blinds or shading systems that can adjust in about 90% of the time. So how do they actually live in this environment when there's like a lot of potential for glare depending on where they are? And can we actually predict what they might do? So the idea is, you know, they could move around at their desk, their chair could move in either direction. And this is essentially what we kind of find that they do in a way. But this is from the previous work, and it just shows that the idea of someone who can't adjust will have a lot of visual discomfort, but maybe someone who can adjust by moving around can really reduce their visual discomfort quite substantially. And this was a video I wanted to show, but but the media player is not on this computer, so that's really sad. It also doesn't even show the right base image. So I'm just going to coupon. Unfortunate. So what we have done is for every one of those 500 deaths, we've simulated annual daylight glare probability calculations for about 19 different views. So it's about 10,000 daylight glare probability calculations. And we also took surveys of all of these, of each, not all of the students, about 100 replied to our survey about how they felt in the space throughout that first half of the semester that they were there. So these dots essentially are just scaled to the predicted discomfort for each desk. So you see the ones near the ends are quite unhappy, would be predicted to at least be quite unhappy. Actually, there's a higher incidence of students who are in glare-prone areas that responded to the survey than in the non-glare-prone areas. So, and I just wanted to share two things from this survey that are potentially interesting and just to think about. So one question that was on the survey was, if you experienced discomfort, how did you actually try to improve that? So a large amount said no, there was no discomfort, I didn't have to do anything. A fair amount of people just dealt with it, they didn't actually do anything either. But these two answers here are actually the largest, and if you add this on top of it, it's much larger. People that actually had tried to adapt by moving around at their desk or changing their like orientation a little bit. So it's quite plausible to happen and still work quite happily. Then there were also people who had more extreme solutions. These people left their desk entirely and just went to work somewhere else. So of course, in some cases, it's not possible to adapt. And some people actually built another shading device, so building retrofit if you want. So I guess what we need to figure out in going forward with this, when we really start comparing the simulations to the surveys, is under what conditions did someone adapt, and under what conditions did someone actually give up and have to do something else? Another interesting question we asked was about basically productivity and efficiency of working. So we wanted to know how the lighting conditions actually influenced their productivity. So very few people said the lighting had any sort of positive influence on what they were doing. And even greater, the largest quantities that it didn't influence, but you notice for certain tasks the negative influence is different. So black corresponds to reading and writing. This gray corresponds to building physical models, which is just something architect students do. And red corresponds to actually using the computer. So it kind of stands to reason with veiling glare that using the computer would be one of the most potentially problematic things, but also one of the easiest to fix by simply just turning your monitor so the specular reflections aren't there. So that's where we are with this and with all three of the projects, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions you might have. Yes?
Trying to negate it or reduce it, do you think there's also a danger in totally reducing sort of direct sunlight, that there's a danger of creating quite uniform and boring spaces, and then to try and also have a bit more visual stimulus in sort of lighting patterns and things in our kind of architectural kind of detailing and manipulation of the stuff?
I agree with that, actually. This one, I'm going to go back any further. So in this space, when you can see that it's actually quite dynamic in a way, like this is actually, I think, a nice place to be. If I was an architecture student, I'd be happy to be in this space. But the idea behind this adaptive visual comfort system is to say, well, instead of introducing some sort of automated controls, how likely would it be for any given design to actually have a reduced use of shading devices? So, of course, if you always put the blinds down, you have a relatively uniform amount of, not uniform, but there's no pattern of daylight on the floor if you want, or on your desk, but you can probably live with a certain amount of it, and that's one of the questions we want to get at. And of course, maybe this is okay, and it actually makes you a little happier to have these direct sun next to your desk, but not on it. It's a perceptual question, of course, but something to think about. Yes?
Okay. First, thank you very much for staying. The first case, the city with the solar mapping. What kind of trick? Because I assume you inserted a lot of sensor points to run through Daisy,
mm-hmm.
and I assume they also have angles and not all for orientated marks.
Yeah.
Could you tell something about that?
Yeah, so there was some custom code that went into that, of course, but what it essentially did was from the points cloud, we were triangulating models of each building, and the sensor grid was distributed normally across the floor plate of the building, and the orientations for the sensor directions was based on the normal of the triangle, so you can derive the normal from the three points. So all of these points are coincident with the 3D model of the roof, basically, and they're spaced above the roof a little bit by like a millimeter or so. Yes?
Did you consider using other tools for solving the same problem?
For solving the time problem of the radiance calculation?
For solving radiation maps.
We didn't. In a way, this was about applying knowledge that we already had. Like, so DASIM is validated, and we know that it works, and we wanted to apply it to a new problem that is kind of lacking tools. So, yes, it worked in this problem. The issue was computation time, so we found very quickly that once we had such a large radiance model, computation takes quite a while. So we actually ran in parallel all 17,000 buildings. Yes?
Could you have used an average sky to do the same calculation? Just average it over the whole year, since you're not operating anything here?
Well, I prefer not to because of this. You really want to get at what the hourly irradiance is to calculate the temperature. But the existing maps, basically, essentially, not an average, but they use a whole summation of the sky in a way. Yes?
And another question. I was thinking about the time marks. You use two ambient bounces for the whole scene.
Mm.
Wouldn't zero ambient bounces already be sufficient for?
Yeah, that's actually true in a way. We use two ambient bounces because the idea is maybe in the future you'd have even better models of the city that could account for glazing or different material types. Like there are ways. Kind of underway, but not really used very well, about building good models of cities that would have, you know, all kinds of material properties associated with them, like what's a wall, what's a window. We didn't know that, so everything was a Lambertian diffuse reflector, but we still were accounting for some sort of reflections from the surrounding buildings. So that's why the ambient bounces of two, and yes, it probably added a substantial calculation overhead. Any other questions?
In the Boston irradiation data.
Yes. Yep.
Well, the graph you showed with say all the pluses.
Ah, yes. This one.
The diffuse irradiance is actually higher than direct. What it says.
This might have been global horizontal. This could be a poor label. But you might be right. They could be switched as well. But the idea is not. You know, if you ignore the labels, the ratio issue is still correct, more or less. What's the numerator? What's the denominator? So, sorry about that. Any more questions? Yes.
The potential of savings that we have seen here, yes. Does it count the potential of the solar cell itself to shade underneath, so it can kind of reduce the electricity of the building itself?
No, we didn't account for any thermal benefits to the building. What we accounted for was essentially net present value of the energy minus, you know, installation costs and local economic rebate incentives. So we don't have information, like thermal information about the buildings necessarily, so it's difficult to make that assumption. But of course, someone could argue that if you shade your roof a bit, then there's some reduction.
Okay, this is my first question. My last one is, does it depend on a certain type of solar cells and the potential savings?
Yes, we put in a certain type of solar cell into the map, but that part is quick. You can roughly run the calculation for every grid in the city in about an hour once you have the data simulated. So we could, more or less on the fly if we wanted, try different solar cells. But we used a standard panel that's documented to calculate what is potential in this case. Yes?
Do you take into account sort of cleaning and dirt correction factors and things like that?
No, I guess we assume ideal maintenance, if you want. So that's another potential issue. Rain tends to help. Of course, in the Boston, the winter, there's snow, so we didn't account for things like that. If someone leaves the snow on their panels, obviously, the onus is on them. Yeah, I mean, to a certain degree, we wanted to present with this map was also some sort of, now you get a bit out of the radiance talk, but we wanted to present some sort of idea about what kind of energy should you be using in your house, and maybe it's better to install some sort of retrofit options before you put PVs on. Yeah. Well, thank you.
Thank you.